Music, or do you like technology, or do you like talking to people? CJSF Radio is the place for you. Here at CJSF, the opportunities are endless. You can interview artists and bands, speak up for what you believe in, or even host your own show, and tons more. To find out more information, visit cjsf.ca.
All I can get is static or variations on the central musical rhythm.
I only wish there was some way we could tell it to shut up. It's driving me crazy. Keeps getting louder.
We have no way of estimating the volume this creature can produce.
The only logical solution is to listen to CJSF 90.1 FM. They broadcast from Burnaby Mountain in British Columbia. Let's tune in now.
So these imperialists, together with the Christian Zionists and the early Jewish Zionists, began to push for a change in British policy, persuading the British government that it would serve the British imperial interest to tear out of the Ottoman Empire parts of the Arab world, including Palestine, and in the case of Palestine, build a Jewish European state for the Jews that Europe didn't want. This ideas that became a real policy, despite its immorality, its in many ways impracticality, but nonetheless established new facts on the ground. So this historical context is very relevant to what goes on today.
That's Ilan Pape, and this is Alternative Radio. I'm David Barsamyan. This edition of AR features Ilan Pape on the historical context of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Israel claims that there is no need for explanations as to why Hamas attacked on October 7, 2023. Historian Ilan Pape challenges that point of view. He says that without historical contextualization, the issues are not only incomprehensible, but also make people vulnerable to half-truths and propaganda. For decades, corporate media coverage of the conflict has been lopsided in Israel's favor. Israelis are humanized, Palestinians are demonized. Ilan Pape points out that the Israel-Palestine conflict didn't start on October 7th, nor did it start with the 1917 Balfour Declaration, or with 1967, when Israel occupied the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the Golan Heights, or in 1948, when the State of Israel was declared. Roots of the conflict began in 1882, when the first Zionist settlers arrived in what was then Turkish-controlled Palestine. Our guest today is Ilan Pape. He's been called Israel's bravest historian. He taught at the University of Haifa. Currently, he's professor of history at the University of Exeter in England. He's the author of many books, including The Ethnic Cleansing of Palestine and A Very Short History of the Israel-Palestine Conflict. He spoke in Exeter, England in January 2026. And now, Ilan Pape.
I was asked to answer a very important question, which is why do we need to talk about the history of Palestine and Gaza in order to understand the reality today and have some understanding of what awaits us in the near and more distant future. History here is important because in many ways we are still in the same historical chapter that started with the arrival of the Zionist movement in Palestine in the late 19th century. It's not surprising that Palestinian historians and activists and thinkers call the whole period from 1882 until today the ongoing catastrophe or the ongoing Nakba, or as the historian Rashid Khalidi preferred to call it, the ongoing war on Palestine. So we are in a chapter that actually has history, but we are still part of that history. And understanding that history is something that when it is presented to people with a modicum of decency in them, immediately puts them on the side of the victims, of the colonized, of the victims of ethnic cleansing, of the oppressed. This is one of the reasons that, especially after the 7th of October 2023, but even before that, the official spokesperson for Israel were very adamant that historical context should not be mentioned when you discuss Israel and Palestine. This was a particular important position for them after the 7th of October 2023. You might all remember that the Secretary General of the United Nations, Guterres, although he condemned the acts of the Hamas on the 7th of October, immediately said that we should understand that these acts were not done in a vacuum, which he meant they were done within a historical context. Israel's response was to demand that he would be fired, he would be removed from his position as Secretary General. And this was followed by a very assertive kind of campaign by Israel and its allies, especially in Europe, but also in parts of the United States, to demand that in academic centers, people would not discuss the events of the 7th of October within a historical context. The worst case was Germany, where academics were told by their university management in a very straightforward way, do not mention context. If you mention context when you discuss the events of the 7th of October, you might be accused of anti-Semitism or of supporting terrorism. And I think that the Israelis are, in that respect, are right, as I said before, because the context enable us to have a sophisticated position on the question of Palestine. It also allows us to understand the connection between a one-off event like the 7th of October and our moral and historical judgment of the whole process that brought with it both the events of the 7th of October, but also the Israeli genocidal reaction to them. So in a way, when we are discussing the historical context, in some places, especially in the northern, in the global north or in the west, can be described as subversive, as I said, almost tantamount to supporting terrorism or bordering on anti-Semitism. I want to explain how the historical context became a kind of a contentious subject between those who try to defend the Israeli actions on the ground after the 7th of October, and those of us who want to put the 7th of October, and particularly the genocide that followed it, within a historical context that allows us to understand how we got into this horrible moment in the history of modern Palestine, and what does it tell us, at least tentatively, about the future. Guterres, the Secretary General of the United Nations, was mainly referring to the 17 years of siege. The Israeli imposed a siege and blockade on Gaza, and he wanted to say, you know, although I don't justify what happened, but that's a reaction for people living in the conditions of a maximum security jail or a ghetto or a prison camp. And they broke out of the prison in a way. But in fact, in order to understand both that reality and its future, you have to go back in time, not just to the beginning of the Israeli siege on Gaza that began in 2007. I claim that in order to have a full understanding of what we are facing now and what we are going to face in the future, you have to go to the very origin of the Zionist project. And this is something that is not easy to convey within mainstream media, not only because the mainstream media's position on Israel or Palestine, but also because of the nature of mainstream media that doesn't have the space or the span of attention to have a more elaborate discussion of current events in order to understand them better and to expose the real motives behind certain actions and prepare for what can come next. So I would suggest that in order to understand the last 2.5 years in Gaza, you have to go to the very early formative period of Zionism. And it's important to remind ourselves that Zionism was a European project before it was a Jewish one. And because it was a European project for a very long time, not only when it was conceived, but also it was a European idea to maintain it and its moment of needs. Because of that, I think we begin to understand one of the most bewildering aspects of what happened in the last 2.5 years, and this is the European political elite's at best indifference to the genocide and at worst complicity with the genocide. After all, Israel in their eyes was something that especially Western Europe helped to establish, so as organically connected to it, and therefore any confrontation with Israel is a confrontation with a West European country. And Europe is willing to confront Russia, it is willing to confront every other country in the world, but it will never apply the same kind of yardsticks for behavior or policies or criminal policies to a Western European country in this respect. It began as a European project. In fact, it began as a Christian European project. Certain sections of evangelical Christianity were the first one in modern times, in the very beginning of the 19th century, to bring up the idea that there should be a European and even American support for what they called the return of the Jews to the Holy Land in order to precipitate the second coming of the Messiah, the resurrection of the dead, and the end of time. They were joined in the mid-19th century by a group of Jewish intellectuals, thinkers, activists, who were desperate about the inability of a large section of Europe to accept the Jews in the continent as indigenous people, and saw them as aliens, as a distinct race, as a different nation even. And therefore, together with these early Christian Zionists, if you want, they began to develop a vision of a Jewish state in Palestine as a solution for the fact that they saw no hope for any fundamental change in the position of European societies and countries towards the European Jews. We have to remember that two things happened in the second half of the 19th century that contributed to the consolidation of these ideas. One was the rise of nationalism. We usually call 1848 as the time of the Spring of Nations. And these new European nations, they needed the other that is not part of the nation to define more clearly what the nation is. And the Jews were a very convenient scapegoat for defining modern nationalism, whether it was Polish, Romanian, Serbian, you name it. It was easier to know who is a real Pole, who is a real Romanian, who is a real German by saying, well, they're definitely not Jews. And the Jewish intellectuals themselves began to internalize this idea and say, well, maybe they're right. Maybe Judaism is a separate nationalism, a separate race, and we deserve a homeland of ourselves. We can't have it in Europe. And it was very clear from the support they got from certain Christian institutions that they would try and help them with the political elites to establish a European state in the heart of at the heart of the Arab world, with the help of Europe. Now, all these ideas became were very theoretical until it also caught the attraction of British imperialists. There was a lobby within the British government in the last half of the second half of the 19th century that was unhappy with the British policy of not adding any more colonies to the empire, and particularly with the policy that said Britain should not try to take over possessions that belong to the Ottoman Empire, which included Palestine, in order not to push for the disintegration of the Ottoman Empire that could lead to a European war, which in fact is what happened once Britain deserted this policy of keeping the Ottoman Empire together. So these imperialists began to push together with the Christian Zionists and the early Jewish Zionists for a change in British policy. And the moment they succeeded in persuading the British government that it would serve the British imperial interest to tear out of the Ottoman Empire parts of the Arab world, including Palestine, and in the case of Palestine, build a Jewish European state for the Jews that Europe didn't want, these ideas that might have seemed, and they did seem to many people, including to many Jews, as immoral, impractical, became a strategy, became a real policy on the ground, despite its immorality, its in many ways impracticality, but nonetheless established new facts on the ground. And that history is important because I think to this very day, European intellectuals and academics, and this includes also Americans, because America was later involved in it also directly, did not come back to a very important moment in history. And that moment was immediately after the Holocaust in 1945, when European intellectuals and leaders had a chance of saying to European Jews, because most of the Jews who were in Palestine as settlers were Europeans. There were very few settlers who came from Arab countries or Muslim countries. Didn't say to these settlers, who were about 500,000, please come back to Europe. Our answer to the Holocaust is to build a Europe that would not allow a genocide of anyone, not just Jews, because in the Second World War, not only Jews were genocided. Millions of other people were genocided. We will build another Europe that would make it your home because it is your home. And forsake this colonial project that you built together with Britain, which was only, 40, 45 years old. Not one European intellectual, not one American intellectual, not one European or American leader. But I think we should, at that moment, focus on Europe. America was not as important then to that story as yet. Not one European intellectual, not one European leader said, this is how we're going to build post-Holocaust Europe. No. They all said, what a wonderful idea. The best solution for preventing a European genocide of Jews again is to send them all to Palestine and let them colonize the Palestine and dispossess the Palestinians. This is something that is not ancient history, and this is not something that has been resolved as yet. I'm still expecting European leaders today, European governments, to say to Israeli Jews of European origin, you are welcome back home, even if you are third generation. Of course, they don't have to go. I'm not saying that this is a solution for the Palestine question. I'm talking about a symbolic, significant closure to the terrible idea that Palestinians had to pay the price for the fact that Europe didn't know how to deal with its racism towards Jews. And because it didn't know how to deal with racism towards Jews, it's not surprising that it doesn't know how to deal today with its racism towards African, Arabs, and Muslims. So this historical context is very relevant to what goes on today. Now, of course, there is a more immediate historical context, which you cannot forget, especially when we talk about the Gaza Strip. And this has to do with the fact that this European project, built on the bayonets of the British Army, eventually was powerful enough in 1948 to deal with one of the two most important challenges that faced this idea of solving the problem of European Jews by building a European Jewish state at the heart of the Arab world. One challenge was that not all the Jews in the world agreed that this was the solution. And Israel tried to solve it by claiming to be the state of all the Jews and used a lot of energy and propaganda. And I'm not sure that in historical perspective they succeeded, but time will tell. But the second challenge was the more important one. How do you turn Palestine into a Jewish state when the majority of the people are Palestinians and there are the indigenous people? And in 48, there were the circumstances that allowed Israel to try and change dramatically the demography of Palestine by ethnically cleansing half of the indigenous population, by destroying 500, which were half of their villages, and demolishing most of their urban spaces. And in that project of ethnic cleansing, and I'm not sure how many people are aware of it, the Gaza Strip was created. There was no Gaza Strip before 1948. Gaza was organically connected to the rest of Palestine. It was a very pastoral place, both the city and Khan Yunis, which was the second largest town. And then there were the other villages, very fertile, very rich agriculture and trade centers connecting Egypt with Syria and further afield Turkey, and being in family, blood, social and cultural and political connection with every other important town and center in Palestine, whether it was Jaffa, Acre, Haifa, or Jerusalem and Nablus and Halil, Hebron. Israel created the Strip because it had a problem of what to do with hundreds of thousands. In fact, 200,000, the exact number was. There were 200,000 Palestinians, which Israel found difficult to find a new place for them after kicking them out from their villages and towns. The other 550,000 Palestinians Israel had expelled in 1948 were pushed towards Syria, Lebanon, and Jordan. These 200,000 were meant to be pushed forcefully by Israel into Egypt, but Egypt did not allow them to cross the border into the Sinai. So David Ben-Gurion, the Israeli prime minister, found a solution. He said, we can give up 2% of Palestine, 360,000 square kilometers, and push the refugees into that strip that we will create with the agreement of the Egyptian government, and actually turned it into the largest ever refugee camp in the world. In Gaza were 80,000 indigenous Gazans, if you want, and they had to absorb within 3 months 200,000 people. Of course, they had no infrastructure, no way of doing it. And Gaza became one of the most dense populated enclaves in the world. So that is also part of the story, because 70% of the Palestinians in Gaza are descendants of these people who were expelled. And many of them were expelled from villages on whose land and whose ruins some of the Jewish settlements that were attacked on the 7th of October were built. And this also gives you some sort of a context that is important for understanding what happened, not necessarily justifying everything, but giving you a good idea of what was happening. And of course, even a more recent context are the years of Israeli occupation since 1967, and in particular, and I think this is something that, again, mainstream media either doesn't have the patience to mention or doesn't want to mention, is the fact that life in Gaza in particularly became unbearable already in 1994, ironically, as a result of the peace effort, as a result of the Oslo Accord. This is, by the way, also true about the West Bank. But in Gaza in particular, life after 1993 was far worse than life between 67 and 1994. Israel encircled the Gaza Strip with a barbed wire in 1994, limited the number of Palestinians who could work in Israel, and increased the power of the settlers, who were only a few thousands, allowing them to take over water sources, fertile land, and created with them wedges between Palestinian and this very, very, very dense and small piece of land, and made the ability to move around, to shop, to visit family, to find work, much more difficult than it was before 1994, which meant that unemployment was on the rise, and with it also the determination not to give in to such a way of life, especially when that way of life was produced by a false promise of peace and a different reality, which of course Israel never meant genuinely to fulfill when it signed the papers of the Oslo Accord in 1993. And it's not surprising that for the people of Gaza, since 1994, the organizations, the outfits that they felt deserved their support were not judged by their ideology or by their ideological visions of the future. They were judged by their willingness to confront this life in the largest ever refugee camp that incrementally became one of the largest prison camps in the world. And the support went to those who opposed the Israeli occupation and not for those who decided to find a kind of a collaboration with Israel, with the hope that this would somehow serve themselves, maybe, but also their own people, by securing some sort of pacification of life, I mean the Palestinian Authority. This is important to understand because the Israeli narrative of the 7th of October and also their justification for what they did after the 7th of October is that actually this whole operation was instigated by Iran. It's part of an Islamist attack on Jews or the state of Israel, on the West as a whole, totally ignoring, of course, on purpose, the fact, the explanation for the support for the political Islamic groups, for their ascendance, for the agenda that they had on the 7th of October, which included one of the most important issues, included the probably what most Palestinians in the occupied West Bank and the Gaza Strip would regard as the most sacred issue, the issue of the political prisoners, hoping that abduction would lead to a prisoner exchange, miscalculating the Israeli government's indifference to the fate of the hostages taken by the Hamas, and also the wish to break out of the kind of prison Israel created in 2007 with the policy of blockade and siege that turned, as I said, the biggest refugee camp in the biggest maximum security prison on earth. And to this, of course, you could add the international community focusing on the Ukraine and not paying attention to what was going on in Palestine, which was not just a problem of a shifting attention. It was a problem of hypocrisy. The way that Ukrainians were praised for their actions, while similar actions by Palestinians were prescribed as terrorist and Islamist and fanatic.
You're listening to Ilan Pappe on the historical context of the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. This is Independent Alternative Radio. For copies of this program, call us 1-800-444-1977. That's 1-800-444-1977. Or online, our website, alternativeradio.org.
So all this is important. And it also tells you something about the viciousness and the callousness of the Israeli actions after the 7th of October. It is important to say that, of course, and I don't want to deny it, that there was